My word. A panel game devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason. Dennis Pyle and Frank Muir challenge Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden in a game about words, with Jack Longland in the chair.
We go straight into the first round, which tests their respective vocabularies. And I want to know, for 2 marks, what is the dictionary meaning of these particular words? Frank Muir, a katydid. K-A-T-Y-D-I-D. Katydid.
Katydid is a kind of cricket found all... not game, because it's found all over America, and that wouldn't be found in America. It's a kind of insect. It's a... with bent legs at the back, which is found... It perforates all over the United States.
Colour?
Oh, yes, yes. It's I've got to say, it's an insect colour. Sometimes in some lights, it takes on the tone of its surroundings.
Foliage.
Yes, yes, exactly. Green.
I'm bound to let you through on that, I think. It's a large, green, locust-type insect, lives in trees, and produces by stridulation, which you won't know.
Not without another mark, I think.
Well, that comes of rubbing your legs against your thighs or your wing cases, whichever way you prefer.
It's a grasshopper, as far as I can make out.
It is, like a locust. And that makes the noise. Katydid, katydid, katydid. And it comes in Eastern and Central America, and you just get your 2 marks. Anne Scott James, an imbroglio, and I won't spell it.
It's got a G in somewhere, hasn't
that's
it?
That's right.
Imbroglio.
Well, it means a sort of... noisy and violent involvement, does it not?
Yes, I think that's fair enough.
Sort of an undisciplined.
That's right. Yeah. That's what I wanted. Yep. 2 marks. A confused heap, a state of embroilment or inextricable entanglement, a complicated situation, or in music, oddly, an ordered confusion. 2 marks. Imbroglio. Dennis Norden. A shawm. S-H-A-W-M.
You're now looking at a confused heap. Not only have I never seen this word, I don't think I've ever seen a word that looks like it.
I think you're forgetting the Book of Daniel.
Oh, I keep forgetting. I must wear a rubber band around my wrist. Remember Book of Daniel. Well, is it mentioned in the Book of Daniel?
Mm-hmm.
Favorably?
Oh, yes, very. Yeah. Well, noisily.
Oh, then it's a musical instrument mentioned in the Book of Daniel.
Yeah, I think it's the Book of Daniel. I may be wrong on that. Oh. Anyway, in the Old Testament. Dennis, I think, one. It's, I think, a now obsolete musical instrument of the oboe family, which had, I'm told, a double reed enclosed in a kind of globular mouthpiece. And it comes from an old French word, which derives from the Greek, which meant reed. 1 out of 2. Dennis Power. Crinkum, crankum. C-R-I-N-K-U-M, and the same again, but with a crank this time. Crinkum, crankum.
Well, that is a phrase used in the old days when your car stopped in the middle of Piccadilly and you got out amidst a jeering crowd and turned a handle, crinkum, crankum. It did, didn't it?
It's a lovely idea, Dennis.
Well, it's
and,
quite right.
Well, I did it and you did it, yes, I agree, yes. But
yes.
It isn't quite what I want.
Not quite what you want. Well, it's a kind of twist-em,
yes.
Turn-em. Twist-em, turn-em, yes.
2 marks straight away. Absolutely right. It means crooked, full of twists and turns, or much too elaborate, or very, very intricate. And it's a playful invention of a word from crank, and Dillis was quite right about this. It's like cranking up a car. Ladies and gentlemen, for those who like to guess ahead at the stories, Frank, what's your quotation for later on in the program?
Mine is from Lewis Carroll,
And it's time to come on board with said speaker of many things, of shoes and chips and sealing wax and of cabbages and kings.
And yours, Dennis?
Mine's from Hamlet. It's Horatio's description of the ghost's countenance, more in sorrow than in anger.
Right. Well, you remember those, ladies and gentlemen, and now we go on to a round of drinks. Some questions to be answered on the topic of tippling. Two marks, who said or wrote these? Frank Muir, they who drink beer will think beer.
It's a good line, actually, isn't it? It's a... It was written... It wasn't written. It was noted. It was quoted by Washington Irving.
That's what I wanted.
I think when he was in England at Liverpool. And he certainly didn't invent the line because he wasn't capable.
Frank has broken through brilliantly. This is Washington Irving in his sketchbook called Stratford, and I think it was when he was on tour here in England in the 18th century. They who drink beer will think beer, two marks. Well, now to Anne Scott James. He is believed to have liked port, but to have said of claret that it would be port if it could.
Well, port was enormously popular in the 18th century.
Yes. A distinguished classical scholar.
A distinguished classical scholar. Oh, Bentley, I would think.
Absolutely right. This is Richard Bentley, who lived between 1662 and 1742, and no doubt had a great deal of port, a great deal of college high tables. And this was what he said about port. Two marks. perhaps they still are. Now, Dennis Norden, I've made it a rule never to drink by daylight and never to refuse a drink after dark.
That's a good rule, actually. can't tell anything but the style of that, actually. Yes. I've made it a rule never to drink by daylight, never to refuse a drink after dark.
He had ideas about women as well as about drink.
Well, that really doesn't make him terribly exclusive. particular.
Ideas about transatlantic women.
But did his epitaph, self-written epitaph, talk about a homely woman?
There you have the advantage of me, Dennis. I didn't know.
Well, I was thinking of Mencken.
Yes, that's right. Absolutely dead right straight away.
If you would...
Tell me what he's...
Well, I can't remember it all, but if what he wanted his epitaph is, if you would want to please this shade, then wink at some homely woman.
Splendid.
And something else beyond that.
Well, I think that's wonderful. I mean, he's got the epitaph as well, so I'll give him 2.5 marks this time. Well, Dillis Power. Work is the curse of the drinking classes.
Oh. Sounds like Shaw.
Irishman, but...
Irishman, not Shaw.
Not Shaw.
Not Shaw. In my right ear, a voice says, Oscar Wilde.
I think the voice in your right ear is probably accurate.
I'm very grateful to it.
This is attributed to Oscar Wilde. I'm not absolutely certain of the accuracy of the attribution, but I'll give you all 2 marks, because that's what I've been told.
Thank you.
And now we have a round of origins and derivations, and for 2 marks, how did the following words or phrases originate, or from what did they derive? Frank Muir first. A seersucker suit.
It derived from the material out of which the suit was constructed, Jack.
Place of origin?
All strange small boats with funny names are Mediterranean. These are the things you learn when you do a lot of these programs over the years. And all materials with a funny name are Indian.
Yes,
particularly their cotton, which seersucker is. It's that stuff with wobbles in it, isn't it? It's all stripy stuff which Americans, businessmen, used to wear as summer tropical suits, because it had the advantage that it looked creased before they put it on. So there's hardly any difference when they took it off.
One and a half for bravery.
I would say.
One and a half for bravery, I think.
We think it's rather good explanation. Yeah.
Very good so far. But the bit you've missed is that it's a corrupted form of the Persian shir o shaka, which means milk and sugar. Well, now to Anne Scott-James, and your word, Anne, is paraffin.
Well, I presume it isn't from the Greek para, is it? It couldn't have anything to do with that, with those F's.
Latin.
Paraffin, what could it come from? But F, you don't get that in any language known.
It is.
You maintaining it's a Latin word?
Yes, it is Latin.
Do you know the fin part?
It's a Latin derivation, though it was invented not before 1830.
Oh, and apparently it's getting so expensive that none of us can afford it anymore. So it means it's now a material which has come to a finish. That's the end.
Again, one mark for trying. Derives from the Latin perum, which means little or barely, and affinis, meaning having affinity. And a chemist called Reichenbach in 1830 named paraffin in this way because it was a neutral thing and hadn't much affinity with other chemical bodies. And that was why he called it paraffin.
That's very difficult.
Now, Dennis Norden, I haven't a clue. C-L-U-E, if you prefer it that way, or it could be C-L-E-W.
Well, I've never seen it written C-L-E-W, and to the best of my knowledge, this was a wartime. I can't remember hearing this expression ever before the war. It was a great RAF expression, and its origin seems to be implicit in its meaning.
You don't think Sherlock Holmes ever used it?
Yes, because the last question was a chemist called Reichenbach. And didn't Sherlock Holmes perish for the first time at the Reichenbach Falls?
No connection between the two questions. Oh. Sorry,
the CLEW business is important.
That's fairly important, yes.
The labyrinth.
Yes, what
goes
happened
back
there?
Goes back to Theseus.
And how did you get in and out?
How'd you get in out of the labyrinth?
Mm.
Well, clever old him got out with a reel of cotton.
That's right. That's
and he left the cotton behind and followed it into the labyrinth, killed the Minotaur, and then he could find the way back.
Mm. Absolutely
but I
right.
still don't quite see.
And then by, metaphorically, I thought...
You said, I have a clue.
That's right. Originally, it was a ball of yarn or thread, and you had to have that if you were going to find your way into and out of a labyrinth, which Theseus and Ariadne did in Crete. And hence, clueless, to be lost or disorientated. I think it's, so the dictionaries say, that the alternative spelling, C-L-E-W, is the actual thread or ball of thread, and C-L-U-E is the sort of thing that you find in Agatha Christie's stories.
I just find it difficult. When I joined the Air Force, I was shouted all up and down Blackpool by a flight sergeant who used to call me a clueless clot.
That's right.
And I cannot think he was referring to a ball of string in a lamp.
Well, at any rate, he didn't think your name was Ariadne.
You'd never kill the monster.
Yeah. You're rather good to take out a ball of thread and say you are quite incorrect, sergeant.
And we go back to Dennis Powell, who knows quite a lot about Crete anyway. Crete, and not the same kind of question to this. Yours is gooseberry fool. Origin.
Origin? Well, gooseberry foo is a mixture of stewed gooseberry, sugar, and cream.
Yes, that's fair. And if you like it, custard as well, I think, but a lot of people
don't. Well, I don't like custard. No. No. Custard. No.
And how do you suppose it came to be called foo?
Because some people were fool enough to eat it with custard.
For that culinary snobbism, I'm about to give you 1.5 marks. I think it's a back formation, or at least so the dictionaries say. A fool is a chap who trifles, and therefore trifle and fool are equivalent terms, and therefore this, which is a curious form of trifle, pudding, became known as fool. 1.5. Well, now we come to the last round, and Frank and Dennis's quotations. And the marks will be awarded on the length of the applause from the audience here in the theatre, And Frank, you'll remember your quotation, which was of shoes and ships and sealing wax, of cabbages and kings, and as you correctly said, comes from Lewis Carroll's Walrus and the Carpenter.
This editor of the Sunday paper, one of the thick ones too, not one of the skinny ones, rang me up and asked me whether I'd do a piece about my pet hates. It seems they're doing a series of asking elderly people what they suddenly get irritated by in modern life. In the food line, I object to Parma ham. I don't know if you've had Parma ham. It's like a slice of ham, but it comes from Italy, and it's smoked, and it's very thin, like a very, very, very skinny, translucent slice of bicycle inner tube. And you chew Parma ham, and you chew, and you chew, and it doesn't diminish. And the other thing was that, you know, nature, smashing stuff, it's all around outdoors. You know? But in our garden, due to the fact we have no cats, we've got about, I should think, about 17,000 birds. But they elbow each other. You can see them elbowing each other off the branches. The noise they make. And there's a great crow who says, Frank. He actually says, Frank. I'm walking past and you hear, Frank. And I say, yes. And you feel such a fool besides anything else. But I think the worst thing are the noise they make. The cheep, cheep, cheep all the time. There's a mimic there. I haven't been able to spot him. But there's a mimic who imitates my phone. I've got one of those little lightweight phones which goes, cheep, cheep, cheep. And this bird does that. And I'm wandering at the far end of the kitchen garden, and I hear, cheep, 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 cheep. And I sprint at my age to the garden, and the phone isn't ringing at all. It's this bird. I object to that. I object to people making facetious remarks about my height. When I walk into a house, they're saying, mind you, Ed, we don't want the ceiling down. Or else they say, stand up quickly and bring the ceiling down. We could deal with the insurance money. That sign of waggishness I object to very strongly. I object to talking to cabbies when I'm being driven along, because, for one thing, it doesn't work. For one thing, they talk, but they're talking forwards. You can't hear what they're saying. And you're talking forwards, so both the voices are going forwards and none is coming back. And crouch there kneeling on the mat at the window, waiting to get to the traffic light so they're going to hear something he says. And I have nothing to say to a cabbie. All I can say is, been on holiday, the back of your neck's very brown. I'm kneeling on this coarse coconut matting with my face pressed up against the aperture in the glass as I am in a high-speed mobile confessional. I like my little jaw with a customer. And I don't like the names that pop groups adopt now. They seem to me to be illogical. You know, in my day, they made sense. You had a group called the Ink Spots, you know. But nowadays, You get they're sort of illiterate, aren't they? They're like the Who. It's the Whom. Very upsetting. And the Slade. The Slade. It's the Slain. And the Kinks. Now, what sort of name is that for a pop group, Kinks? As far as I'm concerned, all it describes is my garden hose when I recoiled it for putting away. So I say those are the things that I object to. So when the editor rings me up again and asks me, I'll accept. I shall say, yes, yes, the time has come, I shall say to him, to talk of many thinks. Then I'll go a bit Lewis Carroll and say, of chews and cheeps and ceiling wags, of cabbages and kinks. But
I think we all share some of those dislikes. And we go on now to Dennis Norton. And his storyline, if we remember, was more in sorrow than in anger.
Madam Chairperson, ladies of the Hampstead, Highgate and District Literary Society, in responding to the toast of the guests at this, your annual literary dinner and conversazione, I feel I owe you an apology on two counts. Firstly, for making this formal response wearing a pair of gardening trousers and a wonderful Radio 1 T-shirt. Secondly, and perhaps more importantly, for the embarrassment and acute shock to which I subjected this distinguished company half an hour ago by running stark naked down the full length of this magnificent banqueting room. Now, it may appear difficult at this time, with so many ladies still receiving treatment from the St. John's ambulance man, it may appear difficult to offer an adequate defense of either of those social solecisms. Let me tell you the reason why I haven't accepted this kind of invitation for 20 years. It's my dinner jacket. You see, Madam Chairperson, the only dinner jacket I possess was one I purchased at the time of the Festival of Britain. Now, that was, of course, 1951, and I'm afraid that, like Britain, I'm just not in the same shape that I was then. Consequently, for the last 20 years or so, whenever an invitation has arrived for any formal function, my response has been conditioned by something the famous American writer and naturalist Henry Thoreau once wrote: beware of any enterprise that requires new clothes. Well, here, Madam Chairperson, we come to the crux of the misunderstanding. You see, I wrongly conceived the notion that, for once, this was a function where I wouldn't need a dinner jacket. Why did I conceive that notion? Well, Madam Chairperson, because your handwriting, like that of so many sensitive people of literary bent, does tend to possess rather more character than legibility. That's why, as I now realize, I slightly misread your last sentence. If you remember, it said, my ladies all feel sure that it will provide an additional sparkle to the evening if you will appear as guest speaker. Well, I read that as guest streaker. Is that all there is to it, you may ask? In fact, that's what dear old Mrs. Hopkins did ask as I passed her chair. Well, no, it's not exactly the whole of the story. You see, you do have to admit that, A, you were offering an unusually generous fee, and B, there has been quite a lot of publicity recently about this new fad of booking male strippers for all ladies' social functions. So, putting all things together, I wouldn't say I was quite delirious at the prospect, but I reckon that by arriving in just the old gardening trousers and the T-shirt, doing a quick peel-off in the gents, then sort of working up a burst of speed going through the residence lounge... Well, it's still an easier way of earning a few quid than sitting in a hot studio twisting quotations. It was, Madam Chairman, simply a series of misunderstandings. If I seem to harp on that somewhat, it's simply because of the many harsh accusations your ladies have been hurling at me since I first made that goose-pimpled jog-trot through the gilt entrance doors, the most wounding of which... apart from the jug of hot coffee, The most wounding was the statement made by Mrs. Culbertson when she seized the speaker's mic and alleged that I was making a gesture of middle-aged defiance of the kind Mr. Sinatra has enshrined in the phrase, I did it my way. Well, Mrs. Culbertson, for your information, and because this is still a literary evening, that phrase was coined by Paul Anka, not Frank Sinatra. And what's more, I did not look upon it as a gesture. It simply seemed to me, in Henry Thoreau's phrase, the first enterprise in years that did not require new clothes. In fact, if I have to apologize in literary terms, the most appropriate defense comes from Hamlet. My reasons for doing it were, in Horatio's words, more in Thoreau than in Anka.
Well, I always wanted to know how women's luncheon clubs managed to collect their subscriptions, and now I do. And by your vote, ladies and gentlemen, Frank Muir wins the story, and he and Dillis Powell also win the entire contest, and that brings to an end this edition of My Work.
Taking part in My Word were Anne Scott-James, Dillis Powell, Dennis Norton and Frank Muir. The chairman was Jack Longland. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore and the program was produced by Tony Shrine.
You've been listening to My Word from the BBC, heard each week at this time. This is the WFMT Fine Arts Network.